Senate will please come to order. Roll call.
Roll call for Monday, February 2nd. Anderson District 2?
Here.
Anderson District 28?
Here.
Barnard?
Here.
Bebout?
Here.
Burns?
Here.
Case?
Present.
Christensen?
Here.
Coe?
Here.
Cooper?
Here.
Kraft?
Here.
Dockstetter?
Here.
Driscoll?
Here.
Emmerich?
Here.
Escobel?
Here.
Geis?
Here.
Hastert? Hicks,
here.
Johnson,
here.
Kinski,
here.
Landon,
here.
Meyer,
here.
Pappas,
here.
Perkins,
here.
Peterson,
here.
Ross,
here.
Rothfuss,
here.
Scott,
here.
Von Fladern,
here.
Wasserberger,
here.
President Nicholas,
here.
30 present.
This morning's prayer is by Father Conkleton.
Let us pray. Lord God, as we gather today and begin our week, we celebrate Groundhog's Day. The groundhog saw his shadow this morning, and so we only have 5 more weeks to this session. No, wait, that's 6 more weeks this winter. Pour forth your warmth into our hearts as we continue the work that we do so that we may have renewed vigor and enthusiasm so that by the light of your grace we may be assisted in the tasks that we still have to accomplish. Guide and direct our deliberations and debates and enable us to act with insight and wisdom. With your divine help and assistance, may we accomplish that which we, by our own efforts, would be unable to do. We also remember this day, Lord, former Senator Liz Byrd, who will have her funeral this afternoon, and former Senator Earl Christensen, whose funeral will be later this week. Welcome them into your eternal kingdom and give their families consolation and comfort. We ask this in all things in your holy name. Amen.
Amen. Please join me with the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Will the reading clerk please read the Journal Committee report?
Mr. President, your Journal Committee reports that the Journal of January the 30th, 2015, has been read and recommends that it be approved. Senator Jeff Wasserberger, Chairman.
Senator Anderson.
May I have privilege of the floor, please?
I'll tell you what, let me just read this part of the script and I'll be right with
you. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry for the interruption.
That's fine. You've heard the reading of the General Committee report. Are there any objections? There being none, the report is adopted. Now back to Senator Anderson, privilege of the floor.
Thank you, Mr. President, for the delay. As we begin our important debate, continue our important debate today on Senate File 129, members of the Senate, I'd like to take the pleasure of introducing my family, or at least a big part of my family. So if you would, off to your right, my son Matthew. Matt's a physician, a urologist practicing in Wisconsin. He's watching, I think, with considerable interest as to what our action here is in regard to Medicaid and that. His wife Stacy, and of course my wife Pam, many of you know, and all the little ones. So if they'd all stand, these are the most significant people in my life. So if you would, please welcome them. Thank you, Mr. President.
So The doctor of the day is Dr. Broomfield. I don't see him there. We'll introduce him later. There's no nurse of the day. Today in Wyoming history, 1848, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was signed, ending the Mexican War. The treaty transferred certain territories to the United States from Mexico, including some of southern Wyoming. Today is day 15 of the proposed 37-day session. Friday is the last day for bills to be reported out of committee of the House of Origin, Committee of the Whole. So this will be a busy week. Our student page is Scott Broyles. Scott, why don't you, if you will, we'd like to give you a pen, but I'd also like to have you take the occasion to have you introduce yourself to everybody. Come on around on this microphone. We're glad to have you. This is the pen that we give to students. And then you can just go ahead and tell everybody a little bit about yourself and
Good morning, everyone. My name is Scott Broyles. I am from Arlington, Wyoming, and I attend school in Rock River. I currently live on a ranch, and I'm the president of our FFA program. I'm in the starting five of our basketball team, and I'm really excited to be here. And this is a wonderful opportunity for me, and I hope I get to meet everyone. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. We're glad to have you. Father Conkleton gave his prayer to President Earl Christensen. He was the former Senate from Weston County. He passed away recently. He was the President of the Senate from 1969 to 1971. He passes away at the age of 95. And he's the uncle of Dick Morrison, our Education Committee Secretary. Messages from the House.
January the 30th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 187, Committee of the Whole indefinitely postponed. Mr. President, the House adopted the Committee of the Whole report failing the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill number 153. Local Sales and Use Tax Revisions. Ayes 27, noes 33. The bill has been indefinitely postponed. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Marty. See, I don't think we have any select committee reports. Okay. All right, we're at that order of business, bills on second reading. Set of file 111, and I think actually with Senator Perkins, were you going to ask to have Senate file 111 summary probate proceedings laid back for a day?
Yes, we laid that back one day, Mr. President. I appreciate that. We've got some comments coming in and want to see if we can make sure we're all on the same page before we move that to second reading.
All right. Do I need to still read it in? Or I don't think so. All right. Without objection, Senate file 111 summary probate proceedings will be laid back for second reading for one day. That ended second reading. We're now at that order of business. Bills on third reading. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, do you have a consent list?
Mr. President, we do have a consent list, and I move the third reading consent list, which is follows. Senate File 41. Employee Online Privacy, Senate File 50, Tribal Liaisons, Senate File 93, County Road Fund Pavement Management, Senate File 99, Wyoming Pharmacy Act Amendments, Senate File 105, Game and Fish Roundup Program, and Senate File 117, Air Quality Construction Permitting.
Would any members like any of those bills removed from the consent list? Having been read three separate times, the question is, shall these bills pass the Senate? Senate File 41, Employee Online Privacy. Senate File 50, Tribal Liaisons. Senate File 93, County Road Fund Pavement Management. Senate File 99, Wyoming Pharmacy Act Amendments. Senate File 105, Game and Fish Roundup Program. And Senate File 117, Air Quality Construction Permit. The Chief Clerk will please call the roll.
On the consent list, Anderson District 2.
Aye.
Anderson District 28.
Aye.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
Aye.
Case.
Aye.
Christensen.
Aye.
Coe.
Aye.
Cooper.
Aye.
Kraft.
Aye.
Dockstetter.
Aye.
Driscoll.
Aye.
Emmerich.
Aye.
Escobel.
Aye.
Geis. Hastert.
Aye.
Hicks.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Kinski.
Aye.
Landon.
Aye.
Meyer.
Aye.
Pappas.
Aye.
Perkins.
Aye.
Peterson.
Aye.
Ross.
Aye.
Rothfuss.
Aye.
Scott.
Aye.
Von Platern.
Aye.
Wasserberger.
Aye.
President Nicholas.
Aye.
Closing vote on the consent list, 30 aye. Senate File 41, are there any changes?
Hicks, aye to no.
Bebout, aye to no.
Driscoll,
aye to no.
Johnson, aye to no.
Wasserberger, aye to no. Peterson, aye to no. Coe, aye to no. Perkins, aye to no. Dockstetter, aye to no. Geis, aye to no. Kinski, aye to no. Barnard. Barnard, aye to no. Anderson, 28. Aye to no. Anderson District 2.
Cooper,
aye to no. Christensen, aye to no. Closing vote. Burns, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 41. 13 aye, 1 no. I'm sorry. It's Monday. 13 aye, 17 no.
There we go.
Senate File 50. Are there any changes? Geis, aye to no. Landon, aye to no. Wasserberger, aye to no. Hicks, aye to no. Coe, aye to no. Kinski, aye to no. Christensen, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 50, 23 aye, 7 no. Senate File 93, are there any changes? Scott, aye to no. Case, aye to no. Closing vote. Perkins, aye to no. Hicks, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 93, 26 aye, 1 no. I'm sorry. 26 aye, 4 no. Senate File 99. Are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 99, 30 aye. Senate File 105, are there any changes? Meyer, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 105, 29 aye, 1 no. Senate File 117, are there any changes? Burns, aye to no. Case, aye to no. Johnson, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 117, 27 aye, 3 no.
Having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the Senate, Senate Files 50, 93, 99, 105, and 117 have passed the Senate. Senate File 41, having failed to receive the affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the Senate, Senate File 41 has failed to pass the Senate. Do we have any more messages? Nothing to read in? That clears the desk. We're clear. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the floor, or clears the desk, I guess is a better word.
Mr. President, may I privilege the floor?
You may.
Yeah, Mr. President, member of the Senate, it's the intention of the floor leader to try to work these bills on general file, whatever time it takes, but to try to be out of here for sure around noon for those that may want to attend the services for former Senator Liz Byrd. And we'll probably come back about, and I'll look at the scheduling between 2:30 and 3 to give everybody time to attend those. With that, Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself and committee the whole discuss bills on general file.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion's been carried. Senator Case. Let's see how your vision does. It's a good thing.
Where's the whiskey? Committee of the Whole will come to order. The first file for our consideration is Senate File 0129, continued from last time. Would the clerk please read the file?
Senate File 129, Medicare Share Plan, sponsored by Senator Von Flateren. I don't have the... Oh, there it is. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Kraft, Landon, Peterson, and Scott. No, Senator Driscoll, Senator Scott, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriation, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended failed in accordance with Senate Rule 5.4. Aye, Senator Hastert. No, Senator Burns, Perkins, Ross, and Wassenberger.
Is your mic on?
Yeah. My mic's. Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the file. We've already had a motion on the file. I believe there were two standing committee amendments. As I recall, the first one failed and the second one passed, if that's my recollection. Senator Von Flateren.
Mr. Chairman, you're correct in your assumption of how things went on Friday, and there are further amendments, and so I'll sit down and be quiet while that happens.
Thank you. The first amendment for our consideration is Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. Would the reading clerk please read the amendment?
Senate File 129, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Corrected Copy, page 1, line 5.
Who's going to offer this amendment? Senator Pappas, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chairman,
thank you for correcting me, Mr. Chairman. I would offer the corrected copy of the Committee of the Whole Amendment 1. You should have gotten a copy this morning. Basically,
Senator Pappas, we need you to move the amendment first.
Oh, yes. I would like to move the amendment, please.
Done.
All right.
Go ahead. Please continue.
Thank you. Basically, as we left this Committee of the Whole Amendment last week, there have been some additions to it today, and I would thank our president for his willingness to help us through some of these items. And so I'd like to run you through the amendment today. Basically, this amendment will create four new sections, and it will create a health reserve account. It will provide for continuing appropriation. It will provide time limit on Medicare expansion, provides for a sunset date, requires reporting, and will modify the standard budget developments for the departments that are affected. In the first section, if you go to lines 14, we have the creation of the health care reserve account. It's created, and the account will consist of monies appropriated but unspent as a result of Medicaid expansion under this article. In little paragraph B, you'll see that the directors of the Departments of Health, Family Services, Insurance, and Corrections shall, on a quarterly basis, identify for the governor all funds appropriated to the programs in their respective agencies that would become unexpended, unobligated, and available for transfer due to the programmatic savings resulting from Medicaid expansion under this article. And I want to take particular attention on line 26, that it shall not result in the reduction of any current services. Basically, we're cost shifting. So we're taking programmatic savings out of accounts identified and moving them, but the reduction in services will not happen. It'll just be, the cost will just be shifted. The Department of Health shall, it requires the Department of Health to specifically report on collective identification of funds. That will be done on a quarterly basis regarding to the unexpended and unobligated funds that are forecast to be available. And those will include, and if you'll look down beginning on line 37, little Romanette I, that it'll include the dollar amount and revenue source of savings to date. Romanette 2, the dollar amount and revenue sources of savings forecast to become available. Romanette 3, the agency division unit and series of savings to date. And on the next page, page 2, Romanette 4, the agency division unit and series of savings forecast that will become available. Romanette 5, the demographic characteristics of the beneficiaries of these health care services. Romanette 6, Romanette 6, the county and major service category from which each of these, each type of savings was generated or is forecast to be generated. Then in line 18, little c, this requires the state auditor to certify the dollar amount and that the governor will promptly transfer the funds to the health savings account pursuant to his authority. Little d, line 24, the funds in the health care reserve account are continuously appropriated to the Department of Health and only to be expended for the state's share of the expanded Medicaid program, including the cost of any contract for administration through any third party, should that third party be hired. Line 30, little e, funds in the healthcare reserve account shall not be expended for any other purpose without further legislative authorization. Then beginning on 34, a new section 49, Medicaid expenditure reporting.
I think that new section is 409?
409, excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Department of Health shall report to the Joint Labor, Health, and Social Services Interim Committee and Joint Appropriation Committee, basically on no later than November 1st of each year. In Romanet I, you can see the total expenditures of the Medicaid program are going to be reported. Romanet II, the number of eligible individuals participating in the program. Next page, page 3, Romanet 3, the average cost of services provided to each eligible individual. Romanet 4, the aggregate amount of payments made to service providers. Romanet 5, the summary of the average cost per procedure for the top 20 most common procedures. Romanet 6, an analysis of the administrative costs borne by the department or contract administrative services. Then on page, on our line, still on page 3, on line 15, section 410, basically provides for an expansion waiver, a time limitation, and reporting by the Department of Health. In paragraph A, little a, any Medicaid expansion waiver negotiated shall be for a maximum period of 5 years. The department shall report annually by October 1st on the status of Medicaid expansion. And the report shall include, line 29, the total federal funds and state funds expended for Medicaid expansion. Line 32, historical and projected enrollment trends. Line 34, historical and projected changes in expenditures by programs resulting from Medicaid expansion. Line 38, the department's recommendation regarding the continuation or the termination of the Medicaid expansion. Then finally, in paragraph, line 43, little paragraph C, any Medicaid expansion waiver pursuant to this article shall not be renewed or extended again without legislative authorization. That brings us to Article 411, or Section 411, Medicaid expansion waiver sunset. This provides for a sunset date of July 1, 2021. Then the balance from line 9 through 39, is a new section that's inserted that will amend 9-2-1002, and it basically allows for the standard budget for the Departments of Health, Family Services, Corrections, and Insurance shall not include any funds transferred to the health care reserve account or funds expended from the health care reserve account. And then the balance of the amendment basically does a bunch of renumbering. And let me point to you on line 43 when it says delete A. It doesn't mean delete the entire paragraph of A. We're only deleting the parentheses and the letter A, as there is no paragraph B. So we're just basically renumbering. And then 45 through 47 deletes the second Senate Standing Committee amendment to these lines. With that, I'll stand for questions.
Good questions about the amendment?
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, there are features in the amendment that look well worked out. I think there are some areas that we need to further discuss and make sure we know what we're talking about. Question number one, on page one, paragraph B. In the middle of the paragraph, we say that we give the director flexibility to go into other Medicaid accounts, but then we put a restriction on it, saying that any savings that are resulted from the Medicaid expansion shall not result in the reduction of any current services. And I'd like a further discussion about that element. My first question is, why would we put that restriction on? And it may be that while there's a reduction, they were duplicate services, or in the total analysis, these folks can, while there might be a reduction in services in one program, they may be covered in a different way. So by leaving this language in, it seems to me that you restrict the director's hands pretty closely, and or maybe beyond that which he can operate. So I'd like to have a discussion on that paragraph. Over on page 2, on lines 24 through 28, item number D, we have language there about the health care reserve account, and I think that's one account we just need to have more discussion about in terms, first of all, how do you intend for this to operate? So we have federal funds, and we have state funds, general funds. My assumption is that we would not be commingling general funds with federal funds, and in some instances, with respect to the federal funds, they would just be moved from one category to another category, or from one expense series to another expense series, and it would be expended, and the monies would never actually arrive to be deposited anywhere. So I assume that we're only speaking of general fund that would end up in this health reserve account. But I think we need to clarify that and further clarify that to the extent that federal funds are moved around, that they will be captured, identified, and then in the Chapter 17 process at the end of this, happening every summer and the end of the summer, they'll be recategorized. And I believe that's the purpose of the lines 30 through 33 on page 4. So there we're saying if the gist of this, I believe, is to give the director the capacity to go in and identify programs that he believes should see a reduction in revenues or general fund, take the general fund and the accompanying federal funds and either put them in the reserve account or hold them or realign them in the new account. Now, the third question I have is with respect to the continuous appropriation. It seems to me that there ought to be some limitation with respect to the amount that can be removed and from that account. It ought to be not more than what's been profiled for this bill. But to say that they're continuously appropriated, so you have general funds going in and being replenished, it seems to me that that's a problematic aspect of this that language, so that we ought to have a discussion about what monies which would go in there, but to provide a continuous appropriation is different than a reauthorization or a reappropriation for a specific purpose. Continuous appropriation means to me that monies keep coming in and they keep coming out, and it may be, well, you could have $100 million flowing through there. It seems to me that we ought to identify the general funds that are being moved. There ought to be an authorization for those up to the amount of the fiscal note of the bill, but no more. So we ought to have a discussion on those three items.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Pappas, you've already got three things on your plate, so let's take it right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regard to the language that's in line 26 and 27, and shall not result in the reduction of the current services. Basically, the intent of that language was that the services that are presently being provided, it's not the intent to reduce any of those services to save money to pay for the Medicaid expansion, but that these offsets will be because of the Medicaid expansion, or the availability of subsidized coverages through the insurance exchanges, they will decrease or eliminate the need for paying for those programs out of the current monies that are being paid. So basically we're shifting who's paying. The intent, there are folks that are fearful that we may delete programs because we're going to pay for Medicaid. And the intent of that language was to make sure that we're not deleting programs. We're just paying programs out of a different fund. And if there's any other language that would make that more clear, I'd be more than willing to listen to that.
How about the other?
And as far as the reference to line 26 through 28 on page 2, as far as the continuously appropriated appropriation, I believe the President's comments are correct. I think we are looking at a reserve account that will be continually flowing. Money's coming in and money's coming out. I'm not the guru on appropriations, so if there's other ways to provide language that would allow for that, I'll yield to those who are more knowledgeable on appropriations than I am.
Okay, Senator Von Flatern, and then we'll get Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The good president is correct that we could put, if they want an amendment in there, continuously appropriated as needed or something of that basis for the cost of it instead of just flowing money into this reserve account and it building up. What we need is 14.6 or whatever the prediction is in 2020. So that account needs to build up. It needs to be appropriated as needed, and maybe that's the language we need in there. But I will point to the last page where the standard budget for the departments, blah, 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 shall not include any funds transferred to the health care reserve account. So that takes care of that double-dipping aspect where they bring down one of their programs, move the money over there, but still go in and get fully funded on that program they just moved money from. So that takes care of the double-dip aspect. But once again, I will emphasize that the first question about the they shall not cut services, and that's very important.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Landon, did you want to jump in here?
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I do appreciate the senators both trying to address a little bit of our concern with regard to these transfers of funds. And I go back to a committee hearing that we had up on the third floor where the director indicated to us on the committee that he would only be able to accomplish, this moving around of various budgets and make this budget neutral if he had the flexibility to do so. And if we put too many strings on a bill like this, you can understand, and I've reminded a couple of times during this session, that can have some impact on a department. If you look at the verbiage on page one, everything underneath that and well into page two is all a bunch of recording requirements, Mr. Chairman, that I think we just need to have some caution on that front. Part of what we're trying to do, I think, on the one hand, is provide flexibility to the director of the Department of Health, but then on the other hand, we're putting all kinds of strings and all kinds of bureaucracy in place that may or may not drive a bunch of numbers in that department and eliminate our ability to do this on a cost-neutral basis. And so I guess maybe a little more conversation on that front might give me a little better feeling about the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Landon. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I applaud the sponsor for trying to tighten this up. I'm trying to remember the exact language that we had in the footnote, but I think it went to the term demonstrated savings. And I think that's where the sponsor is trying to get with this tighter language. Because frankly, especially in the mental health area, where you have mental health parity, and they're saying we're going to get $61 million, the very likely could exist that the mental health local offices could get a lot more money through the mental health parity and insurance. But they're getting new customers, too. And you can't necessarily say that if one mental health center got $10 million before this and they got $10 million after this, you can't say that there's necessarily a savings, because you've got maybe twice as many customers that walk through the door. And so really getting that demonstrated savings to make it cost neutral and not just go in and grab money because they're treating their funds like a block grant, and whatever they want, they say, well, we're going to put this in the savings category without demonstrating that it's actually happening. And I think the sponsor's gone a long way toward tightening that up. I'm not exactly sure whether it's 100% there, but we're not tying the hands of the department. We're just saying that if it's going to be cost neutral, there's no double dipping within the department. And you really have to demonstrate the savings to pay for the program.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and I have several other questions about this, but I'm concerned about the interplay with page 4 in the amendment about the standard budgets being decreased. And is this a net decrease in total standard budgets, or are these standard budgets now in this new reserve account that's continuously appropriated? I think that's unclear in this amendment. And I have real concerns about the continuously appropriated language when it has to do with the administration of the health department and a major program within the health department. It is starting to look to me like a scheme to remove the Appropriations Committee's ability to scrutinize that particular program in that particular department. And we've talked previously here on this floor, Mr. Chairman, about some of the risks of a continuous appropriation. And I really wonder if that language is appropriate in this case. And I would like to see, I would urge some more debate on that particular point. And then when we're through with this issue, Mr. Chairman, I've got several other questions.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I study the amendment a little further, I think the amendment intends to go down a direction of accountability. But there's two accountabilities I think we need to really be careful we're talking about, because as I understood the explanation of the bill, there was the promise of cost neutrality, and that is we know that there's a 10% obligation by the state to secure the federal funds. So with respect to those general funds, they have to come from somewhere. And the department says, if you give us the flexibility, we will identify services that are duplicated, and we will move those funds, remove them from certain object series codes, and we will move them to this account. So that's type, we'll call that transfer type 1. Then there's a transfer type 2 that I'm not sure that we've discussed. I've heard it alluded to, but I don't know that there's been detailed discussion. And the type 2 funds are those where you might see a one-time savings that the department would like to say, we're going to park that money for future years and carry it over into another budget year, to make sure that if there's we have the cost neutrality in the future. So, for example, suppose we've authorized the governor to identify 10% of $100 million, about $10 million a year. But what happens if they see a savings of $30 or $40 million on account of the $100 million? Can that $30 million be identified? If you identify it, where should it go? So you've got two different things happening here that we need to be talking about. So with respect to the $10 million, if in fact there's reduction, there's a duplication of services that a object series is reduced, so you have a mental health substance abuse account that's now being taxed less because those services are now paid by by this program, those dollars should actually be removed from that series and go to the next series. And you actually should, in the Chapter 17 process at the end of the budget, the fiscal year, that ought to be permanently reduced until such times they're reappropriated. And so then you put the money back in or into this reserve account. And it seems to me that the appropriation authorization ought to be limited to that 10% that we were promised this program would not exceed. Now, $100 million, there is this other general sense out there that there ought to be more money than the $10 million where there we're seeing savings in various programs. Now we've got an interaction between health, family services, insurance, and corrections. So we've got three or four different departments, each one, I suppose, voluntarily or is mandated to identify services that their budgets historically paid for, but those recipients are now getting these benefits. And suppose it's more than $10 million. Should they go into the reserve account and be continuously appropriate? I submit not. I think the solution is that you'd have you direct that they can only be retrieved through the B-11 process. That's a form process that we authorize the governor to sign a request to take it out. But that B-11 request ought to be never more than the fiscal year 10% that's being provided. So if that's the way I understand what we're looking at, is we're looking at different series, then we probably ought to tighten it up a couple ways. One is that the governor ought to be another question I have under the first paragraph is, who's choreographing all this? Is it Department of Audit? Is it the governor's budget folks in A&I through the Chapter 17? Or are the agencies themselves just offering up their money? Or is the governor, we're asking the governor to do a more active effort where he's actually directing and going out and making sure we identify these funds, we find them, and we pull them out, even if the agencies might not like to release them. Now, I have also a question with respect to when you say duplication of services. Oftentimes, services are rationed by the amount of their budgets. And if you leave more money, there's less rationing. So at some point, somebody has to make a difficult call to say, we do think these services are now being rendered by another program. We're going to remove them, and they still may have to ration. So I'm still concerned with the language that's a mandate that says no services can be reduced because the program actually is going to get cut back.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Von Platen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Trying to get the questions down straight. To the tall senator from Turner County, I think the rationale on the back there, the fact that it's not in their standard budget anymore, automatically gets appropriations to look at it. They don't have it, and so then they have to make the request to have it. The fact that they have to report so much also says that appropriations is looking at it. They know about it. As far as retrieval of the funds, I wasn't clear on that if Mr. President meant that the money would be put into that health care reserve and then only by B-11 process out. That may be a possibility. The B-11 reports are given to appropriations. It is the governor that is dispensing them, so that is written into the bill as we go today. But I don't quite understand if that's what the president meant. Was it the B-11 process that's the only way the funds came out, or if they needed additional funds, they'd have to go through the B-11. So I need a little clarification on that, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, in general concepts, let's talk about $100 million going into health care. And we've heard over and over that there's cost shifting, that this is going to reduce the cost in other programs. And So we don't know how much of the $100 million is actually going to be pay for services that are presently contemplated under the program. But I'll give you an example. Suppose it's mental health substance abuse. If we're giving monies out in block grants to mental health centers, and now we're going to pay them for additional services, how are you going to reconcile that? Are you going to say we're going to lower their block grants because they're now receiving some compensated care? I suppose if you're... So I could think of a number of areas where we have general funds going to pay for services that are now going to receive additional payments. And we've been through this problem before, but I assumed that, in fact, I think there was discussion earlier on that when you put $100 million into this system, you're going to see savings, and more than $10 million. In fact, the advocates say that, you know, if you implement this program for 3 or 4 years, you might see $50 to $60 million in general fund savings, and that's why you would want to continue this program beyond 5 years. It seems to me that if the effort is to say in the immediate term, whatever general funds that are expended have to come from savings from other programs, that just pays the 10% down. Now if the challenge is, will this program save the state somewhere as much as $50 to $60 million so that at the end of the day we can say we should continue to pay this even if the federal government reduces their contribution because we're saving money. That was the promise, that there'd be cost shifting. Now, if we just acknowledge up front that that's not going to happen, that this is more money into the system, hospitals are going to make more money, everybody's going to make more money, and everything's good, then that's the way the system ought to be promoted. But that's not the way this program was promoted. So now we're talking about putting $100 million in, and we're going to go comb through all these programs and find out where there are duplicated savings or whether there's cost shifting that we can identify, and we reduce those programs. But so that comes out of those programs, reduces their appropriation, so the only way they can get it back is by coming in and asking for an exception to their next budget. So the auditors go in there, these are the budget people, go in and say, well, you saved $10 million last year because of this new program, we're going to take it out, 10 here, 10 here, and maybe they find $40 million. But that would not be an authorization to spend the $40 million. There should only be limited to the 10% that we were promised that this program would cost. But I guess part of what I'd ask the sponsors of the bill is this a program that is not going to see any savings across, and this is just an extra $100 million every year, and it's just going to be absorbed? Or are there, in fact, services that are currently being provided that we're going to see a savings to the state? And it's apparently it can happen in the Department of Health, Department of Family Services, and the Department of Insurance, and the Department of Corrections.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Von Flatron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to be having a debate between just two of us, so if you want to invite somebody else up at some point, I will answer the fact that, yes, this program is being presented as saving us money, not only bringing $110 million of federal money in on the first year, but also saving us money. And I do believe, I don't know whether it's 10%, I'm a little lost in that number, but a hypothetical 10%. So the money will be saved in these programs, and I'll bring your attention to this one handout that was given to you Friday, which is the programs that the department has identified in their department that they can save the money from and pay for the program. It will cost 14.3 or whatever that number is in 2020. We know that for a fact. That's how we'll ratchet up. And from then on, supposedly, 14 point some million dollars every year after with any inflation added to that. But it should save more than that. If you look at this sheet alone, the programs he's identified, we will be cutting their budget for those programs, not for the first 14.3 million or whatever that number is initially, because they need that to continue the program, but any savings below that. And if you look at that sheet, there is more than $14.3 million on there. So that is a savings to the state. And I don't think I can really, whether we do the block grant, that's where the savings would be, to the mental health substance abuse, or and the other programs identified, it'll be, those will be lowered to the point you get to 14 point whatever you need in 2020 and any other further savings, and that may start in 2016, will go back, be given back in some manner. But, yes, it is to save money and bring the federal money in.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to add to that a little bit, I think the Chairman gave a good answer to that, to the President. But the concept of how much is saved in a given year relative to the 10% is one thing I wanted to discuss. The first year that 10% match on the state's part isn't going to exist. So the concept of this savings account in the first year really is going to be putting more in than would be needed. Now, that's a policy choice by the body, and it's certainly not a requirement. If that's not what the body feels like, we could make an amendment to that and change the structure. But the idea was to identify those savings and recognize that the state share was going to increase over time up to the $14.5 million. There still will be sufficient savings, even in that 2020 and beyond, to meet the $14.5 million needs. But in these early years, you could bank and accrue some additional funds to recognize that and then use that for other possible health care programs. Now, if that's not the desire and we want to trim that and make sure that we're cutting it lean, I think that's very reasonable, a reasonable policy decision. It seems, Mr. Chairman, to me to be reasonable either way, but at the will of the body, which one of those directions we go. With regard to the shall not result in a reduction of current services, I think that's a good point, and perhaps we need to readdress that particular language. The intent there is fairly obvious, but perhaps the wording is not correct to get across the point that there will be specific services that are shifted over, but the overall service to the community is not intended to decrease through this program because the offsets are going to provide equal or better care to this population. Mr. Chairman, hopefully that answers or at least further clarifies some of the questions that we've had so far.
Thank you, Senator Rothfuss. We are still on Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1. We have several amendments to go. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, on page 1 of the amendment, line 21, it speaks to the Department of Corrections. And I would ask, why is that included? What is there in corrections that would be affected by this Medicaid expansion? I know with conventional Medicaid, I think incarcerated individuals are not eligible to participate. And the feds do that because they know the state is obliged to pay 100% of their health care costs. Is there something different here? Maybe there's a good reason to include that, but I don't know what it is, and I would ask why.
Thank you, Senator Perkins, and then we'll go to Senator Pappas.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just following up, I'm worried that to quote one of our members here a little while ago was about squishy numbers. I'm wondering, as we talk about these things, I'm worried. First of all, I understand the concepts behind various savings, and I'm trying to make sure that I understand two things. I think first of all, how certain are we? Have we visited with the department who's in charge of who will be in charge of monitoring this, of providing those savings in the form and in the amounts and in the manner in which we're indicating or asking in this amendment? For example, Mr. Chairman, if a few years ago we had seen a significant increasing level in Department of Corrections budgets, particularly in the number of inmates that it looked like, and ultimately that flattened out at least for a while. And so when we went back and looked, trying to figure out why did that flatten out, the guess was that it probably had to do with something that we had expended in expanding the mental health and substance abuse issues. We had probably diverted a number of those individuals away from incarceration as opposed to that. We went back and talking to different directors of the various departments about how we could figure out if that was really so, if that was really the reason behind the leveling off of inmate rates. And we never could get any solid numbers on those. So while I understand the concept, that we would want to, if indeed this program does entice savings or create savings, you know, when are they in such a way that we can really identify that? Because the amendment as it's drafted now requires both the dollar amount and revenue source of savings, the dollar amount and revenue source of savings forecasted, wants it down to the agency, division, unit, and series of savings to date. So that's your downside in you know, as you go down to the Department of Health, you could be in the mental health and substance abuse, you could be in developmental disabilities, you could be in seniors, you could be in any number of things. That gets you down to that section. But now we're talking about revenue code. So that when we get down to series, we're talking about whether it's wages and benefits, or whether it's other services, whether it's a Series 600, whether it's a Series 900 contract to a third party. I'm just wondering, when we get down here, if it's really going to be possible to identify those types of savings. That's question one. Question two that I would have, Mr. Chairman, I think comes about with respect to when we talk about cost savings. Are we talking about cost savings because it's indeed really cost savings, or just simply because we're having more money put into the program because we're now moving from 50% federal matching amounts with the under the existing Medicaid to where we're in this now 100%, and then it's to 98%, and then 96%, and then 94%, and down to 90%, or is it just because we're shifting those expenditures over there? So if that, I'd like to know if ultimately when we talk about the cost savings, are we really talking about cost savings, or are we just talking about keeping better track of where the federal dollars are now being spent as opposed to where state dollars were being spent in the past?
Thank you, Senator Perkins. Senator Pappas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding the language on the corrections, I would like to yield to our esteemed president. This was some language that he wanted to see in this, and so I would ask that our president please offer his explanation.
Well, Mr. President, it's good to hear from you. That was cleverly done.
I won't be shy. Well, I think the
I'm glad you didn't go for a forward pass in this play.
Mr. Chairman, I will acknowledge that I'd ask staff to put language together and budget staff. So with respect to corrections, I think the budget staff put that language together, and I believe that what we've talked about is exactly what happens, is that that right now we have a significant general fund paid for medical services provided through Department of Corrections. In the event that these inmates now qualify for this program and services, and they will now be shifting from general fund, was described, to a new program that will be partly federal funds and partly general funds. So to the extent that there is a savings to the Department of Corrections, if that takes place, we want to make sure that the general fund dollars and the federal funds are pulled out of that agency, so they're not just cost shifted or moved from one series to another by the agencies. But we do have if the issue is, and what we're seeing is that, and we're being told that we're going to see savings throughout a variety of agencies, and the challenge that we issue is go find them, identify them, and pull them out of those committees, and then park that money. Or not those committees, those departments, and park the money. But parking means parking. It doesn't mean a continuous appropriation. Now, if the notion is that these monies will be captured during the first year, and they'll be available then for expenditure in the next year, then there's no reason for a continuous appropriation, because the agency can come back and actually get an appropriation, an authorization to expend. There's no reason to give an agency the continuous authority, and in fact, to me, that's exactly what the concerns of the whole program is. One of the comments that made by one of our colleagues was, we collect this money, and then once we collect it, these savings will determine whether or not we want to provide it for this program or other health care programs. And those are the words that cause people great concern, that We never see savings. We never see collections of dollars. All we see is we throw in more money, and if one agency sees that their budgets are declined or they have less strain on one area of the program, they just provide more services with the more money. So what this amendment does is say this is a five-year program. It will terminate, and it sums, so you can only have a five-year waiver. That's all you can get, and then it terminates at the end of 5 years, the authorization. Well, if there's anybody that here that believes that the agency will not come, or the constituents that you're hearing from will not come back to ask the program be continued, I suggest that's pretty naive. I think we all know that this is intended to be a long-term program. So I approve the idea of banking. Let's identify those costs and we'll see what they really are. If there are no costs at the end of the day, then I submit that the folks that are here will have an easier time to say this is a program that we are or are not prepared to put more general fund in. And I guess as we, I recommend that we move this amendment, but it needs work. And my view of this is that if this new program is going to earn our support, the way we ought to look at it is we know how difficult the decision is right now. We know how many constituents want to have access to these programs that are now emailing us. And most of us have a tremendous number of other emails saying, don't do it. Do not expand coverage. This is not the American way. I mean, you've got a view they believe that it's just a growing government. But part of selling point for the people that are in support of it is two points. One, they're federal dollars, as though they're not ours, but they're federal dollars, and this will reduce savings in other areas so that you'll actually see a reduction in your bills. And never before have we implemented a plan where we said, okay, let's identify those monies, let's park those monies. And then in the end of the day, if in fact we see a $50 million decline in our general fund somewhere, then for our colleagues it'll be easier. So if we collect enough information, then the decision 5 years from now will be this as easy or as hard as the decision is today. If we collect no information and we leave our successors, if we do expand and leave them with no tools, there's no way to evaluate it. So if the federal government says, well, we're going to reduce it by your contribution is now 80% and then 70%, we ought to be identifying those savings to the general fund so we know whether or not, in fact, the promise was there, that we're actually seeing better health, we're seeing reduction in other general fund budgets. That was the promise. But that would not provide for a continuous appropriation. In fact, it would be a very restricted account that was monitored. And we would not use the money to create other accounts. We just reduce our general fund and try to get our general fund Medicaid dollars under control.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I agree with all of those interests. I think it's a very reasonable approach to understand as well as possible how this would move forward, what it does, and what the budgetary changes are, record that, and then try and keep some of those funds in the budget reserve account. One thing I wanted to point out specifically about the budget reserve account on page 2, little e, is a specific requirement that funds in the health care reserve account shall not be expended for any other purpose without further legislative authorization, where that purpose is described in little d, and it's specific to the administration of this aspect of the Medicaid expansion. So it is a very limited scope. It would require, Mr. Chairman, additional legislative authorization and appropriation prior to any expenditure from that account that wasn't directly related to the expansion. So that aspect of it, I think, Mr. Chairman, is pretty well taken care of. But I agree that it probably needs to be a little more refining on the language as we move forward in some of the key points on what we want reported and what the rules of the road are going to be as that moves forward. One other point from my good friend, Senator from Natrona County. He asked a couple of questions. related to how certain are we about the appropriations that are coming, Mr. Chairman, and or excuse me, the savings that would be coming to this program, and whether the department has weighed in. And I would say that the department certainly has weighed in and provided excellent guidance on this, that they could, for this particular plan, would have little or no difficulty working within their current budgets if that rearrangement were allowed to show the savings. So certainly in the first few years, and no reservation even in 2020 at the 10% match, based on how those savings would be realized, which is that you have people who are currently getting a service, they're either unpaid through Medicaid because they're entirely uncovered, or coming in for indigent care or whatever other process. Under this expansion, then, there would be a 90% receipt from the feds, even at the 2020 date, 100% in the beginning, and that would be a significant budget offset. Regarding the nuance of whether the savings that are discussed are simply due to that transfer, the principal aspect of the savings really are that. That's the easy calculation that there is confidence for. In other words, the Department of Health believes that when they do the simple math, we're paying for this person already, fully out of general fund. We can pay for them beginning at 100% going down to 90-10. They do the math on those people that they expect to have savings from, and they realize a significant gain. So that's a difference and a nuance from previous savings that we had through corrections versus mental health care, where you couldn't necessarily make that one-to-one tracking, and that's the direct realized savings that is anticipated. There is an expectation of additional savings that are the more ethereal savings, where they're hard to track. It's hard to have the one-to-one, but if you have better quality of health care and you have better access to service, you're supposed to see savings in other places. But those are not included in the estimates because those are far less tangible. It's the kind of thing that can be hoped for but isn't going to be easily calculatable. So the calculations and the data keeping on this is specific to the one clean 90-10 or 100% federal match versus current general fund coverage right now. I hope that clarifies, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. I am sensing that we're getting close to ready for the question. Yep. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, speaking on and against the amendment. Mr. Chairman, I think we've seen several problems in here. One of them is the one Surface talked about, the corrections. Page 1, line 21, I don't think there's any possibility of savings there. Mr. Chairman, to the best of my knowledge, Medicaid specifically prohibits the use of Medicaid funds for anyone that's incarcerated. And the reason is very clear. They don't want us just having us using their funds to meet our obligations to take care of prisoners. I don't think this bill changes that in the slightest. Second, the insurance department on this line, that would have to come out of the, you can't take it out of the regular insurance operation. That's non-general funds dedicated to the management of the insurance department, which regulates insurance collected from an assessment of the companies. What they've got to be talking about here is the uninsurable pool. And there was a committee bill that's come through here essentially disenrolling all those people because they were getting coverage through the exchange that was cheaper than was available through the uninsurance pool. The only thing that's lacking there is we have to continue some coverage for Medicaid or for Medicare people that are not eligible for Medicare supplement. It's not available in the state. That's an entirely different issue. I can't see any reason to include the insurance department in this. If it's included here, I think it's an example of false savings that aren't true. Mr. Chairman, I think there's a real risk of that here. I don't think it's very clear in the amendment how you judge whether some other program has reduced its expenditures because of this expansion, and whether it hasn't, I think there will be endless disputes. And, Mr. Chairman, there was an experience in another state, Maine, where they tried a reform, almost been a dozen years ago now, and they were going to finance it on savings. And that was one of the big reasons of the failure of the program. They had real difficulty identifying the actual savings. And I think that's a risk here. Second, I think the whole business of continuous appropriation of administrative expenses is a mistake, Mr. Chairman, one we ought not to make. Those ought to be not continuously appropriated, but regularly appropriated every year or every 2 years and subject to the normal scrutiny in the budget process. And third, Mr. Chairman, I think it's quite apparent here that one of the things, if we pass this, that's going to happen is whoever makes the judgment on what's to be shifted and what's not to be, you're going to trade off funds that are providing actual service to our constituents that need those services for more bureaucracy in the health department. And that's what administration is in the health department and in their out-of-state contractor to administer this program. And I think that's a mistake, Mr. Chairman. So for all of these reasons, I would hope we would defeat this amendment.
Thank you, Senator. We're about done. Senator Von Flatern.
The corrections, both the Department of Health and some of the LSO staff said that was a mistake not putting the Department of Corrections in there. Apparently, there is some savings. Maybe it's as small as tobacco cessation that they somehow now qualify. The state hospital, if they happen to be sent there, there are some new qualifications that would reimburse the state for those costs. So that is part of it. This amendment is a good amendment. It may need a tweaking or two, but this is a great basis. I hope you vote for it.
Are you ready for the question? Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Pappas' motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 129, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The amendment has passed. The next amendment for our consideration is Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2. Would the reading clerk please read the amendment?
Senate File 129, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to corrected copy, page 5, line 15.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could I have privilege floor before I move the amendment?
Sure.
Friday there was quite a bit of discussion about what savings we should expect and how you're small-town hospitals and even, of course, your large hospitals will be affected by the expansion and what savings they've seen in the past. On your desk is a Price Waterhouse study done that it took in the first 6 months of 14, which is the most complete details they had at that time. It shows an incredible savings. There's a lot of carriers that they talk about in here, a lot of big healthcare hospitals that had hospitals in states that did not expand and states that did expand. And so they talk about the comparison of what the savings are in those states that did expand. So that's just for information. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Number 2 Amendment to Senate File 129.
Go ahead.
What this one does, it tells the recipients of the expansion that if they don't try to make themselves well, or they don't follow, they buy a non-generic drug when a generic drug is available, that they're going to pay more. So it goes into page 5, line 15, after plan, delete, and it says subject to the following. The first one would be the 5% cap, that it can't exceed more than 5% out-of-pocket for them. Then after that, you'd go to B, participants use the hospital's emergency room inappropriately for a non-emergent condition shall be required to pay a copayment in the amount of at least two times their highest non-emergent program copayment for participants with incomes above 100% of the federal poverty load. Providers may deny service for non-payment of copayments. For D, participants who purchase non-preferred prescription drugs when a generic alternative is available shall be required to pay a copayment in an amount of at least 1.5 times the usual copayment for those drugs. And by the way, this is a corrected copy in case you have the old copy from Friday. So that is the carrot. If that is the stick. If you do these, If you step out and do something on your own, you're going to pay a little more. Then we get into the carrot, which is the wellness program. It says page 6, line 4. On page 5, line 22, let me reiterate that if you don't, the 100% group and above, if you don't make your payment, your premiums and your co-pays, you can be disenrolled for up to 6 months. That was approved in the Indiana plan, which was just approved a couple days ago. So we know we can get away with disenrolling them for 6 months. Page 6, line 4, after year, insert, and this is the carrot aspect, may receive a credit up to $20 redeemable for health-related products such as non-prescription medications, but not just $20 in cash. And if they do the following, but not limited to, completing a wellness exam, smoking cessation, appropriate weight loss as recommended, and are diabetic or controlling or maintaining blood glucose levels, and establishing, maintaining a health care relationship or enrolling in a primary care medical home. Page 6, after 5, line 4, insert, participants who do not complete recommended health behavior challenges, such as a tobacco cessation program.
Easy for you to say.
Yes, it was tough, Mr. Chairman. May be subject to a higher monthly premium for the following plan year. So the first part is all the issues that if you don't do this, you're going to get dinged in some manner. And if you're good and you take care of yourself, you will be rewarded. That is what this amendment does. I hope it doesn't take as much conversation, Mr. Chairman, but there it is.
Thank you, Senator Von Flater and Senator Bebout. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just some questions about parts of this amendment. I understand what we're trying to accomplish, but I'm not sure I like it. You know, we say participants who use a hospital's emergency room inappropriately. Who's going to make that decision? How are they going to determine that? And then who's going to require a co-payment by these people that are on the Medicaid expansion the two times? And I don't see how you're going to be able to enforce that. I think what you're putting is some language in here that just in the practical sense of it will not work. And I'm trying to figure out how you're going to make it work. The generic alternative is tough enough now when you have your own private sector insurance program and you go in there and talk about generics. You get all bogged down. Yeah, we're going to try to do it in Medicaid expansion. I just don't think any of this will work.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification on line 12, providers. Is that intended to include emergency room providers, and are we decreasing the access for health care if that's the case?
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, a couple technical questions. On page 1, line 9, lines 8 and 9, two times their highest non-emergent program copayment. The grammatical question is, what's the antecedent of their? Whose non-emergent program copayment? Is it the Medicaid one? Is it private insurance ones? Whose? It's not clear who we're talking about there. Similar question on page 1, line 18, 1.5 times the usual copayment. What is the usual copayment? Is that the Medicaid one? Is it? The private insurance is all over the map on this one, so I don't think there is a usual. What are we talking about here with those two?
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I have a lot of the same questions as some of those just asked. Getting down to the carrot portion of the amendment, I'm wondering, in order to get this incentive and this reduced $20, do you have, for instance, smoking cessation? How do you know that they've quit smoking? Do they have to provide some sort of certificate from an organization or from some organized program? What if they just quit smoking on their own? And what if you quit smoking 20 years ago? Do you now avoid being able to get any of these incentives? And the same question goes for having lost weight or some of the other things in here.
You probably won't get your $20, Senator Burns. Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try and address those questions in order. Good majority floor leader was curious about who decides as far as non-emergent care and how will they collect. The decision really does come down to the emergency care judgment. If they go to the emergency room and they have something as simple as a cold, for example, the majority leader is here. Okay. Obviously, that's not an emergent care condition, and they can bill accordingly. With regard to how would that be collected or what would the incentive be, particularly for the folks that are between 100% and 138% of the federal poverty level, you can get disenrolled if you don't make your payments. So, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me like there's a pretty significant incentive. You double the amount or greater than they're going to that they would have to pay if they went to a simple general practitioner rather than the emergent care. In that doubling, they've got a major disincentive both from the cost standpoint and the possibility of disenrollment. It seems to me that that's a pretty reasonable stick available within this program. With regard to line 12, when we're looking at the providers and whether that's going to cover the emergency room, this would not influence the emergency room's obligation to treat emergency situations. If it's a non-emergent care situation, there might be some flexibility there. General practitioners would obviously have the ability to make those types of denials. But if somebody comes in, they're bleeding, you're still going to have that same obligation. So it wouldn't change the obligations of the emergency room to treat those types of critical situations, but certainly might change the opportunity and the possibility, Mr. Chairman, if it's not an emergent situation. With regard to the circumstances of the tall senator from Natrona County and his inquiries regarding two times the highest amount or one and a half times the usual copayment, this language is specifically trying to recognize the fact that depending on where you're at with your income level, you'll have different copayment premium requirements. That's part of the conditions of this program, not just for our state, but for any state that's implemented a Medicaid expansion. So rather than putting in hard, fast terms in there, there's a recognition that it's going to be relative to the schedule of copayments that individual has. So that's the reference when it says two times their highest. That means the individual's highest non-emergent program copayment based on their schedule, their income level, and the same is true with regard to one and a half times the usual copayment for those drugs. Again, it would be the Medicaid rate copayment for that individual's plan based on Medicaid expansion times 1.5, which is an appropriate appropriate approach to the calculation, knowing that at different income levels there will be different copayments respectively. Finally, to the good senator from Sheridan County's question about the carrot and whether or not they have to and how do you know for these nuances. Mr. Chairman, to me that's going to have to be settled by rules and regulations and fair policies. It's a difficult problem. These types of wellness programs are used throughout other insurance providers, major corporations, other programs around the country, and they have mixed benefits and mixed returns. They do tend towards positive, but it certainly is reasonable to assume that every once in a while they can be gamed. But the intent here is to recognize that good wellness behavior can lead to better health care and that there are potential rewards for it. So I don't know that that's something that we would even want to get down into the weeds on within the statute, but if the good senator has any suggestions on how we can strengthen that language and clarify it, I'd certainly be willing to support such a change. I'd be happy to answer any other questions if they're available, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Rothfuss. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, as I understand the purpose of the amendment is to attempt to put in incentives that we've been describing as social engineering, whatever, but it's to take out or address the issues that were intended to be addressed by the health savings account. So the health savings account, if it could have worked well, would have been a mechanism to try to teach people how to use services well. So as this is an alternative to that program, all of them require money as the source to push this behavior. And I guess what I'd like to have the sponsors do is tell us two things. One is, what are the amounts we're really talking about here? So in lines 6 through 18 on the first page one, what are the copayments, what are we allowed to charge, and if someone fails to comply, what's the copayment penalty, if you will, for failing to comply. And there's, when we get back to the down to the $20 credit, the same scrutiny that we had on the First Amendment, and that is the committee or the Standing Committee Amendment. Where is that money going to come from? Who generates that cash? Let's have a discussion about that, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's, in probably most of the large towns, there's an entity, an office, and I know one name for it that I don't think is appropriate, but there's a receptionist, probably a nurse, and probably an MD. Where does that fit into this? I hope I was clear enough in my explanation what it is.
I'm in the dark, but Senator Von Platen.
I'll try to explain. The good senator from Laramie County, I'll try to address that question. If they're taking Medicaid, it's whatever it is as far as paying them. I don't know how they fit in otherwise. If they are doing something that's not covered by Medicaid, then they're not paid by Medicaid, so they couldn't accept this anyway. The amounts that were questioned by the good president, the amounts are really could be anywhere from $2 to $10 to $15 on, depending on the individual's income bracket. So we're not looking for a lot of revenue garnered by these penalties because in the overall scheme of the program, it's not a lot. But for the individual, it should be a good reminder and is taking a little bit more out of their pocket, which they don't have a lot in that pocket to begin with. So it isn't garnering a lot of funds for the program. The $20, if it's redeemable for health-related products, I don't know myself. I never asked the department, does this qualify it for a Medicaid payment? As long as it's paying for the Medicaid product that would be covered by Medicaid, yes, it would be. And that would be part of their 100%, and then we'd be paying 3 or 4% the next year and down to 10% eventually of that. So at some point, that'll be $2 out of our pocket. But that's the best answer I have for that.
Thank you, Senator. Are you ready for the question? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, I think probably from what I heard understood from some of the earlier discussions with the department, and I will warn you, Mr. President, that we did not get this material and the whole share plan proposal in a timely fashion in the Joint Committee and really weren't able to work it, which is why you see some of these amendments. The $20, I think, would be counted by the feds as an administrative cost and would have a 50-50 split to it. I don't guarantee that, but I think it's about 90% chance that's right. Mr. Chairman, I would point out on item D, participants who are diabetic, controlling and maintaining blood glucose levels. There's an open question here of who decides. And I say that because it depends a good deal on the individual. You will use an A1C test to measure that. The typical recommendation is that you get the A1C down to 7 or below, but for many diabetics, the doctors will say, no, you better stick at 8 because getting down to 7 will result in too much risk of a low blood sugar, which is potentially fatal. It's not you're better off with a higher level. And with some people, even a higher level than 8 would be considered adequate. So you do have a question there. If the bureaucrats put in some kind of a straight standard, as they're likely to do, it could be dangerous. Mr. Chairman, I think I'm going to speak in favor of this amendment. It's meaning well, but I would warn the Senate it's meaning well very feebly. The co-payments, for example, the problem we have with the Medicaid co-payments is they are so low that providers don't find it worth the trouble to bother. And it just reduces the amount the providers get, and it has no effect on the behavior of the individuals. Now, if you're talking about a $2 copayment or even a $10 one, especially with the larger bills that incur the larger copayment, it's just such a small item in the weeds that it's not worth the administrative cost of collecting. And it's one of the reasons that Medicaid has been totally ineffective at controlling its cost. And this is just going down. It's more of the same. So it means well, but it isn't going to make much difference.
Thank you, Senator. We ready for the question?
All those in favor of, it was Senator Von Flatern's motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2 to Senate File 129, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The noes have it. The amendment has failed. The next amendment for our consideration is Committee of the Whole Amendment number 3. The reading clerk will please read the amendment.
Senate File 129, Committee of the Whole Amendment number 3 to corrected copy. Page 3, line 15.
You've heard the amendment. Senator Bebout, would you move it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 3, corrected copy, to Senate File 129. And members of the Senate, there's a lot of things in this bill that I have some issues with, but I'm trying to at least, I think, solve one of them. And if you go on page 3 and you look at 424402, we have the word temporary Medicaid expansion. I have a problem with the word temporary and getting into this whole discussion what that really means. And then I've added the language after that information there, what technically you need to have in it for the expansion program, to include an only as specified provided by this article for a time-limited Section 1115 waiver. And, Mr. Chairman, what this amendment does, I think, is clearly delineates what we're getting into and how we do it, and if there's something dealing with the time-limited section of it that we haven't committed to something that we don't want to do. So I would hope the sponsors would consider this a friendly amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. Senator Von Flatern. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do consider this friendly, and I think we'll see something that has to do with this section a little bit, though. But it did say we saw it in existing language, extent authorized by this article. But I think the Majority Floor Leader makes it more specific, so this is a good amendment, and I ask for your vote.
You ready for the question?
Question.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I will confess I flat out do not understand this amendment. What does it mean? Does it mean, as I read the provision here, that as soon as practical after July 15, we're going to do a conventional Medicaid expansion? I'm a little unclear what's for the full population or just the below 100%. But, and that is problematic if we put some real reforms in here because it removes our negotiating posture. With this amendment, would we still do the temporary expansion? Would the waiver, as I understand the share plan, apply only to the above 100% of federal poverty? Would it be only that population, or would they be excluded? I'm confused by this amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Von Flatern.
Mr. Chairman, there will be something in the future on this, but what it says, as long as it says by the to the extent authorized by this article, I think we're good. The word temporary is a very inappropriate word for this particular paragraph. I ask for your aye vote on this, and we'll figure on something.
Boy, I'm pretty confident about this. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number 3 to Senate File 129, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
The amendment is carried. The next amendment for our consideration is Committee of the Whole Amendment number 4. The reading clerk will please read the amendment.
Senate File 129, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 4, page 3, line 17.
You've heard the reading of the amendment. What is your pleasure, Senator Hicks?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 4 to Senate File 129. Members, this is pretty simple. You're all standing here listening to the same debate and the amendments that we're having today. The questions I have to generate this amendment is there are states that have already adopted this. It's been in place for up to a year in some states, but yet we have no empirical evidence that it's saved anybody any money. We can't enumerate whether that's a per capita or per program or where the savings are or how they may come. We've amended this bill several times now. I'm not sure exactly what a lot of this is going to look like when we get done. What this effectively does is just, let's say, if we're going to pass Medicaid, let's be cautious. Let's be diligent. Let's study what the ramifications of this does. This just gives us 1 year, if we pass Medicaid expansion in the state of Wyoming, to make sure that we know what we're doing before we actually implement the program. That's all it does. Just sets it out to 2016 as to when this would take effect. Mr. Chairman, I'd ask for your favorable consideration of a yes vote.
Thank you, Senator Hicks. Senator Von Flatron.
I know it was a surprise standing up, Mr. Chairman.
Caught me off guard a little bit.
Yeah, he did. I noticed you were staring at the other side. What this does, effectively, is that we would, if we made this effective in 16, you lose minimally a half a year, 100% reimbursement, $54 million gone. Several of these deletions of dates are actually deletions of dates in which the department applies for the certificates or the waiver, does the paperwork. So by deleting this, he doesn't even start until 16, July 1st, 16, even applying. So you're really going into 17 before you'll activate the program. And in 17, we're losing 5%. We're getting 95, not 100%, as we will for all of 16. So I ask you to defeat this, and the fact that it's not effective until July 1st of 16 at the earliest, and he doesn't even get to apply until then, really we'll be looking at 17, $110 million lost, and at that point we'll be putting 5% in for 17 of our own money into this program. I ask you to defeat this amendment.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion on the amendment? Question. Ready for the question. All those in favor of Senator Hicks' motion that when the committee the whole on Amendment 4 to Senate File 129, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The amendment has failed. The next amendment for our consideration is Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 5. The reading clerk, please read the amendment.
Senate File 129, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 5, page 8, lines 13 through 19.
Okay, you've heard the reading of the amendment. What's your pleasure, Senator Bebout?
Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 5 to Senate File 129 and ask the Senator's favorable consideration. Mr. Chairman, this is a controversial amendment. And what I put in and what the amendment says very clearly is that we're talking about and we want to have a requirement in that these people shall, if able, work. And the amendment's pretty clear about it. It says if they're not disabled, which may include a requirement that those applicants shall, as a condition of enrollment, be employed up to 32 hours per work. And, Mr. Chairman, the up to is a key part of this. I think we would leave the latitude. Certainly some people may not be able to. There may not be jobs available. But I think it's very important that we put this provision in to those people that are on this, that, you know, if they are able to and can, then they should, in fact, work. And then the last part of it, Mr. Chairman, is that if this provision is not included in the waiver, the state shall not fund the Section 1115 waiver. So it is clearly, if this is adopted, you don't have the work requirement in there, then we shall not move forward on the expansion.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Von Flatron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against this amendment, surprised everyone. You cannot force them to work for the Medicaid program, so CMS will turn us down right away. That's the poison pill aspect of this. Who is or who is not disabled? That would be up to somebody, and I'm not sure who and what that definition is of are they disabled or not. So this in itself, it's the first time I've looked at this new language, It said, just says may include a requirement for those applicants shall, as a condition of enrollment, be employed up to 32 hours. So it has confusing language. I'm a little confused, but that's not unusual. But I can see the fact that this is a poison pill in itself, and to define who is disabled or not is not in statute, or I assume mentally disabled, physically disabled. There's so many definitions, I don't know where it would go. So I'd ask you to defeat this amendment.
Further discussion on the amendment. Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and you can sure ask a lot of questions about the language, and I appreciate that. Trust me, if this passes and this bill moves forward, we'll come back with a correct definition of it. The thing that I just think we need to have some discussion, it's not really intended to be a poison pill. You know, we have made a lot of progress in Medicaid expansion in terms of the waivers that are available to the state of Wyoming today that were not available 2 years ago. And we can all remember that debate we had and discussion we had, and quite frankly, the decision that the state of Wyoming made to say no the last 2 years only made it better today for this kind of discussion. So I would say that it's just not an automatic poison pill, that the way things are going to the waivers, this might be something they would certainly consider. So I would, again, ask for your favorable consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. Senator Von Flatron.
Not to belabor the point, Mr. Chairman, and I do agree with the Majority Floor Leader that it would be wonderful if we could stick this in there. But as I said, it is a poison pill. If the provision is not included in the waiver, the state shall not fund. Well, I don't think this is supposed to be not funded by state money anyway, so it's kind of confusing on that point. But I agree that it would be great to be able to write that in, but this will not fly with CMS, and so I ask for your defeat of this.
Question.
For the discussion, ready for the question? Question is on committee of the whole amendment number 5. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no.
No.
The chair rules that it's that the amendment has failed.
Vision.
All those in favor, please stand. I'd go with that. All those opposed, please stand. And I will say the amendment has passed. I can do math. I had 4 years. We're back on the file. Further discussion on Senate File 129. Senator did I have a point of order? Senator Nicholas.
Yes, we just like to have those votes. The practice of saying so we can hear them.
Okay. 17 in favor, 13 opposed.
Thank you.
Amendment has passed. Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Scott, back on the file.
Mr. President, on the file, yesterday I said I would circulate the calculations on the effect of Senate File 129 on hospital uncompensated care. I've had that passed out, single sheet. It's got my name on it. Let me just go through that very quickly. We think that first year, $17,600 would be covered by Medicaid expansion. That figure comes out of the Milliman study. $4,600 of those already have private insurance. Again, the source of the Milliman study. So you've got 13,000 currently uninsured will be covered, which is 15.6% of the uninsured population. Now you need to figure what's going to do the hospital uncompensated care. You multiply that by the approximate proportion of the cost that Medicaid pays, and we heard this a number of times in the hearings that our Senate committee conducted on the Medicaid expansion bills and the interim committee conducted. It's approximately 60%. So you multiply 13,000 by 0.6. You have the equivalent then gain of 7,800 fully insured patients, which is a 9.4% decline in uncompensated care. except you have to account for the 4,600 that are shifted from full, at least full cost reimbursement, probably going to be more than full cost, but at least full cost reimbursement through their private insurance. And they get now reimbursed at 60% instead of 100%. So you convert that change into a percentage, and then which turns out it's equivalent to a gain of 2.2% in the uninsurance rate. So your actual net reduction in the cost of uncompensated care to your hospitals, this pass is going to be 7.2%. Just pursuing the figures, Mr. Chairman. Now, a couple of cautions. The 17,600 figure that we've been universally using is a couple of years old. It may be larger. Some of the other states have experienced a larger gain. So as it goes up, you will have a larger net reduction. The number of that already have private insurance may be significantly larger. We understand that there are about 17,000 people that have gotten in subsidized insurance through the federal exchange in Wyoming, and the best estimate I've heard from the proponents we asked in a committee meeting and they got back to me was that just under 4,000. 3,900 of those are believed to be between 100 and 138% of federal poverty, and they will be converted from private insurance to the Medicaid, and the reimbursement for those will go down to 60% from 100% or whatever it actually is, more than 100%. So, and there's probably some double counting between those and the 4,600. So you can't just add them together, so there's an uncertainty, but probably somewhere in the vicinity of 6,000 or 7,000 of the people that will come on to the Medicaid program will be coming off private insurance, including the subsidized insurance, through the exchanges. So those numbers are going to change this, so you can't take the final percentage as gospel. It may be a bit higher or a bit lower, but Mr. Chairman, it gives us some indication of what this will actually do, and it will be probably relatively evenly spread amongst the hospitals. The Medicaid population is relatively easily spread amongst the various hospitals. Won't be targeted on the ones that are in some kind of financial trouble. It will go across all of them. And what I would emphasize to the Senate, that you may see a little more, a little less than this, but you aren't going to see enough additional to the hospitals so we can say our problem there is solved. We've got some hospitals, Mr. Chairman, that we believe are in various degree of financial difficulties because of what's happened in the healthcare marketplace, because of the federal regulations and the Medicare cutbacks. And we're concerned about these, and 7.2% or 10% or whatever it actually turns out to be, decrease in their uncompensated care, it's going to help. But it is sure not big enough to solve the problem, Mr. Chairman. And I want to emphasize that to the Senate, because I don't want to be standing here a year from now and saying, we got a crisis in the hospital, we got to do something about it. And here, gee whiz, we solved that with the Medicaid expansion. Because, Mr. Chairman, the Medicaid expansion won't solve that problem. It doesn't have a big enough effect.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I really want to thank my colleague from Natrona County. It's very helpful information. One of the challenges with our system is that I'm one of the newbies who was asked to go over to this Labor and Health Committee and was greeted by Senate File 66 and Senate File 129, and that's a pretty heavy climb up a shale mountain, Mr. Chairman, to get up to speed with something that that committee, which was seated during the previous interim, had received testimony on throughout that interim. And so my question, with a little bit of latitude, Mr. Chairman, to pursue this a little bit further, is to ask the chairman or the proponents of 129, do we see the similar kinds of impact in areas that I've been approached on just during this session, which is our senior care facilities, our assisted living centers? I don't know what impact this Medicaid expansion would have on the senior centers out there. I'm not sure what kind of impact this would have on our developmental disabilities list. It's just very difficult to try to get your arms around where's the impact going to hit and what percentages are we looking at. And, you know, when we learn that this will eat into that deficit of between 100 and 200 million in uncompensated care out there in those 23 to 27 hospitals, and we learn that it's 6 or 7% that we're going to have an impact with all the other things associated with it, it gives me pause when I think about all those other areas that I've heard about just in this session. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Landon. Senator Von Fletcher, and then we'll go to Senator Scott again.
Knowing that we want to get people out here at noon for that funeral, sir, I will try to move this right along. I'll refer you back to the study. The study does non-expansion states and expansion states, and it shows a 40% reduction in the non-pay group that comes into the emergency rooms. So this is people that are 40% reduction in self-pay, excuse me. That means that people came in that were self-pay, which would take everybody that doesn't pay too. They had a 40% reduction in that, and they had a little boost in those that came in with Medicaid. This is where people are getting healthier. The hospital in Natrona has thrown out figures of 30%. I've got on the phone yesterday with somebody in Thermopolis. Their hospital there, they're on track to do 1.2 million in uncompensated care. They're running a negative 0.4% in their budget. If they gain a couple hundred thousand dollars, that puts them in the positive on their budget. They break even for the year. Even if you believe the figures of 7.2, and thank you to the tall senator from Natrona County that put this together, that's $1.4 million to my hospital every year, additional money, additional revenue. So let's move the bill forward. We have some more amendments that I'm sure we can figure out the questions we had today, and we'll get after that when we do.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I've got a few questions about this bill. Well-intentioned, but it goes back to the basic questions going back to 2009 about this bill. My first question is, and maybe somebody either for or against this bill can answer it, what is magic about 138%? It's 133, you get a 5% credit, so to 138. And so I guess the question becomes, how arbitrary is that figure? We're talking 70%. The good senator, the chairman of the Labor and Health Committee, has talked about a 60% reimbursement rate to the hospitals. My local hospital is about 70%. But even then, I've got a concern, and if anybody could address this, and the chairman of the committee has mentioned this term a few times, which is the utilization rate. How much more use will go to the hospitals, and how much more strain will they be under, again, this is in the long run, in which they're only getting 60 to 70% of the reimbursement back? It's $108 million, is my understanding. And frankly, if I had faith that the federal government was going to keep this up for ad infinitum, I'd probably be for this bill. But let's take a look at what's facing the federal government here. You've got an enormous debt and deficit. and there's ongoing pressure. There is even a bill here or a resolution here for a balanced budget amendment to force that on the federal government. There's even mention of a constitutional convention to do that. The original legislation, the ACA legislation, pejorative is Obamacare. How were they going to balance the books on this? They were going to take $500 billion out of Medicare. And they said, oh, well, that's just waste and excess. We'll just find that. Well, I think that goes right to the question that the shorter senator from Natrona County was asking about. And then look at the position that members of Congress are going to be in. They're going to be in a position where they are paying 50% of Medicaid up to 100% of the poverty line, and then from 101% to 138%, they're paying 90%. How long do you think that model is going to stay in place? I'm telling you, not long. Some of us have been here long enough to see what happened to the Medicaid, the federal reimbursement for Medicaid. When the earliest I recall, it was 62% the feds were paying. I think it was up to 67%. And we saw it just creep down and creep down and creep down to 50%. And you may say, oh, well, that's no problem, because in this bill it says once it's below 90%, we're out of here. We're just going to end this program. You've seen the political pressure and the arguments going on around this bill, such as you're denying 17,500 people medical care and so forth. Well, imagine the position you're putting future legislators in when that percentage, not if, but when that percentage drops below 90%, the position of the people who are going to be on this floor to actually take away an entitlement. How successful do you think that effort's going to be? How many entitlements have we seen taken away? And the enormous pressure put on people for that. And, Mr. Chairman, for that reason, and we're talking $108 million, so I would guess it's going to come down to 50%, so be prepared. If you're going to vote for this bill, be prepared for you or your successor to start having to cut money to other programs to cover that money, because you know we're going to have to.
Senator Scott. Mr. Chairman, and following on that analysis, which I think is right on point, assuming that we're unwilling and should be unwilling to just raise taxes. You know, our taxes in our mineral industry are as high as they need to be. Our sales taxes as high as it needs to be. Okay, you're going to have to make up 55 to 70 million somewhere in there. Where's it going to come from? Mr. Chairman, the only places with that kind of money in our budget are education, and that probably means higher education more than K-12 because of the court protections in K-12, and aid to cities and counties. You vote for this, you're condemning those people to a major cut 2 years, 3 years, 4 years down the road.
Senator Nicholas, Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I agree with all those statements, and I think the challenge is this. I began by saying you do the analysis as though you're here 4 or 5 years from now, knowing that the pressure is hard to maintain the program. And I'd urge us to work this bill through the full reading process, but it does occur to me there is a choice that we begin marching down, and the pathway marching down is a difficult pathway. But the pathway is knowing that we will end up at a 50% reimbursement, and telling ourselves and charting the way to cause a redistribution throughout the Medicaid program to find those $50 million, because at some point, you do have to sit down and say,
is our current budget adequate to take care of more people? And if we have to limit programs, if we have to provide, if we have Cadillac programs, we reduce them. Those are painful. We've seen that. Every time you want to say to an existing program, we're going to narrow your program, we're going to take away some of the features to come up with that $50 million so that we ultimately provide more coverage to more people, but individually the programs may be cut back. And that is the discussion to have here. And the amendment number, committee of the whole number one, is really directed at that, into saying to the Department of Health, we want you, in fact, we ought to just explicitly say it, we know this program is going to morph over the 4 years under the initial waiver that we're going to put a hard sunset, but what we're looking for you to do is to start identifying how to pay for this program with existing dollars, and that means looking at other programs and beginning to say we have to provide more or a broader net of coverage to more people, and some of the programs and some of the coverages may sacrifice some. But that takes courage. If you love your programs and you think that everybody ought to have, those that are on the program ought to have the Cadillacs, and that we should never expand, then I agree. Don't move down this direction. But if we want to move towards a direction to say we will anticipate picking up more a greater share, and to do that, we will look to the department to begin to redistribute the care we provide so that more people are covered with the same dollars.
Thank you, Senator.
Question.
Anybody else? Heard the discussion. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 129, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The ayes have it.
Division.
Division being called. All in favor of Senate File 129, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. The count is 11. Senate File 129 has passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, should we take a break?
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee hold beg leave to ride and sit again.
Heard the motion. What is your pleasure? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
Do you have any messages? Messages from the House?
February the 2nd, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message number 193. Third reading. Passed. Mr. President, the bill listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 114, Wyoming Repeal Gun-Free Zone Act. Ayes 42, no 17, excused 1. February the 2nd, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message, third reading, passed, amended. Mr. President, The bills listed below pass the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 44, Emergency 9/11 Fees Prepaid Wireless. Ayes 53, noes 6, excused 1. House Bill Number 72, Volunteer Firefighter and EMT Pension Account. Ayes 48, noes 10, excused 1, conflict 1. House Bill Number 83, Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Ayes 36, noes 23, excused 1. House Bill Number 90, Student Religious Liberties. Ayes 39, noes 20, excused 1. House Bill Number 105, Next Generation 9/11 Task Force. Ayes 45, noes 14, excused 1. And House Bill Number 166, Electrical Safety and Fire Prevention Amendments. Ayes 59, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
February the 2nd, 2015, Mr. President, Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 67, Waiver Stabilization Trust Account, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Kraft, Landon, and Peterson. No, Senators Driscoll and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, the Senate File 67, Waiver Stabilization Trust Account, had a great big appropriation and a continuous appropriation in it. Your committee number, so you would expect it to be referred to committee number 2. Your committee number 10 removed both of those. So it doesn't have an appropriation anymore. But if the Appropriations Committee wants to look at it, I'd be happy to re-refer. But, Mr. President, frankly, I think it's a waste of their time.
With or without objection, Senate File 67 is re-referred to Appropriations.
Mr. Chairman?
Without objection.
Mr. President? I will object, unless they want it.
Well, I was trying to anticipate that. If there's a potential fund flow or consequence that comes later, it ought to be referred to Appropriations Committee. Mr. Chairman of Labor, if you believe there's a fiscal impact, I think it ought to be referred.
Mr. President, I don't think there is at this point. The fiscal impact would come much later and be subject to a separate judgment. I think it's a waste of time, but I wanted to raise the issue because in the last days, I don't want something to come off a general file, go to appropriations. I think now's the time to settle it.
Without objection, Senate File 67 is referred to appropriations. They should take a look at it. Shows you what bias I have. All right, Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that we stand recessed until 2:30 p.m.
Announcements. Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your Travel Committee Number 6 will meet at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning in S-14 to consider Senate File 109, State Parks Leases Legislative Approval.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Committee Number 3, Revenue, will meet tomorrow, 30 minutes after noon recess in Room S-16 to take up Senate File 96, Special Investigator, and Senate File 122, Vision 2020.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, will meet immediately in S-11 to hear the re-referral of Senate File 110, State Education Accountability and Assessment Number 2. And your Joint Appropriations Committee will meet at 4 p.m., hopefully, in Room 204 to consider the draft bill of the appropriation.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Judiciary Committee number one will meet Tuesday, 15 minutes after the lunch recess, the noon recess, in S1 to continue Senate File 115, Discrimination.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee, Transportation number 8, will meet upon adjournment in room S14 to consider the following bills: Senate File 95, Speed Limits, Senate File 137, Farm License Plates, and Senate File 127, Transportation and Education Revenue Distribution.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 9, Minerals and Economic Development, has added quantity to their quality and will meet in about 20 minutes in S18. Senate File 84, Enhanced Recovery Carbon Dioxide Certification. Senate File 125, Incineration Permitting Location. Senate File 130, Lottery Commission Reporting Requirements. And 131, Minimum Wage Staged Increase.
No further announcements. You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate shall stand in recess until 2:30 p.m.